Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
I've got a cardboard cutout of Gary Lineker still in my loft. I had like a weird sort of out-of-body experience that day. And I was watching myself on the floor, looking at the paramedics. And then I remember being almost like, it's going to sound really strange, this Kate. I have no way of explaining it to you, but I almost felt like I was sucked back into my body. I don't mean this to sound rude in any way, but is the head consultant around and can they have a look at the scan? Because if I'm going to tell my family that I've got cancer, I need to know 100%. So it was a pretty weird night.
What made you want to walk into that as a conversation?
Concern, I think, Kate. We have a tendency in a situation like that, Philip Schofield, Hugh Edwards, whatever it might be, even the Holly Willoughby stuff more recently, people just fire off rockets in every direction and you don't know what you're going to hit and what you're going to cause and what sort of damage you're going to do.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. Although not today, it's 11 a.m. and my guest and I, well, we're not savages. In fact, he is one of our most prominent sports and news anchors who millions woke up to every day on BBC Breakfast before he switched his alarm off last year to become the face of Channel 5's early evening news. Born and raised in Crawley, he grew up as a sports-obsessed teenager with an ambition to become a sports and news anchor, even practising his commentating as a teenager, watching live matches at home with the sound turned down to perfect what will go on to become his craft. His father is a pastor, as is one of his brothers, and such is his commitment to his faith, he's managed to balance a career in live sports coverage whilst insisting he never works Sundays. After writing to Des Lynam for careers advice when he was 11, he followed his mustachioed hero's advice to the T and started out as a super slick and super enthusiastic commentator for Manchester's Key 103 radio before joining Granada Television and later the BBC, first at its regional news programme North West Tonight and later on Football Focus, where he resided for 12 years, and the BBC's Breakfast Sofa for 6. Having moved to Sheffield to study a master's in journalism in the late 90s, he met his wife there, Sarah, and they've remained in the city ever since, where they live with their three children and his in-laws. As well as anchoring the news on Channel 5, he also hosts a raft of factual entertainment shows for the channel and has recently published his second book. It's called Standing on the Shoulders, and it tells some brilliant stories that chart, well, just some of the extraordinary and yet very ordinary people he's met across the course of his life. But you wouldn't want him on your shoulders, let me tell you. He stands at a majestic 6'6". There's a lot to him, as you're about to discover. So let's dial him in. It's Dan Walker. Good morning.
Hello, Kate. I know we haven't got a glass of wine, but I just have had a pint of milk and I've got some water here. What have you got?
I'm not going to lie, Dan, right? My boiler's not working. My Wi-Fi's on the blink. I'm on my seventh espresso. You can peel me off the ceiling at lunchtime.
It's very nice to talk to you, Kate. Thank you very much for having me on.
You too. I have admired you from afar for many a moon now. I think you live in that sort of really strange world that I resided in for a while, where you're just always there as a broadcaster. You become part of people's everyday fabric.
It's a strange situation. I had just after the pandemic, about a month after the pandemic, there was this I was doing an event and a lovely lady came up to me and I could see that she was quite emotional. And she just said that, I just wanted to come up and I just wanted to say hello, because watching BBC Breakfast every morning with you and Louise and you and Sally and you and Carol, it actually got me through the pandemic. And then she started getting really emotional, started crying. And you forget, don't you, that it's, you know, it's just a job, and I love doing breakfast and I love doing the job I'm doing now. But you get the opportunity to have sometimes a very strange relationship with the people who are watching. And that was, and I've had so many conversations like that over the years, and it just reminds you that it's, yes, it's TV and there's cameras and there's lights and it's a lovely job, but essentially you're talking to somebody at the end of that camera, and that's a really important relationship, and you should never forget how crucial that is for so many people.
Especially the kind of programming you do. And I noticed a real switch in the way people responded to me when I transferred from sort of Saturday night telly to daytime. Mm. So on Saturday night telly, for example, in the supermarket, people would sort of, you know, nudge their partner and say, oh, look, it is, I think it is her. Is that Neil McAndrew? You know, always getting you wrong. But then once you're on telly, on daytime telly, they would then come up to me and say, oh my goodness, how's your Ben? How did he get on at sports day? You know, because you just have a much more, I don't know, it's a far less removed relationship. It sounds very like we're being very grandiose here, but actually it's really important. You know, fundamentally we work for broadcasters, but we don't. We work for the audience. And that's why I love podcasting, because they're my bosses. They decide how many downloads each week, not a scheduler.
But this is going to sound like grandiose is probably a good word to describe it. But I see myself as a broadcaster and a journalist. And I the reason why I love that job is because I think it's a really important role, particularly at a time now where, you know, truth and trust have never been more important. And, you know, we are saturated, aren't we, with facts and stuff that we need to check on social media and online and even in, you know, the papers. Who do you trust and what programs do you trust and who do you listen to? And I think as a journalist, I do fundamentally believe that my job is, you know, we can be the sword for people who can't fight and the shield for people who can't defend themselves, and we can ask questions of those in power, and I think that's an extraordinary privilege, and I genuinely don't take that lightly, and I know that that's a really important role, and I enjoy doing it. I'm not interested in fame and all that business. I know that comes with part of the package. I just love doing the job, and that's always been what inspires me, whether it's, you know, watching a football match, covering Wimbledon, going to the Olympic Games, hosting a news program, interviewing the Prime Minister, whatever that might be. I feel so lucky to have done this job, Kate, really.
I feel very much the same when it comes with regard to our profession. It's interesting, I just had Adrian Charles on recently, and he said, you know, the one thing he struggled with was and you just talked that you had the Prime Minister for 30 minutes, and, you know, trying to do something meaningful in 3 minutes is really difficult. And he said, what you end up doing is just becoming like a narrator where nobody gets to speak, you're trying to over explain everything, and there just isn't the time to do that. But this takes me actually quite nicely to my first question for you, if that's okay. Would you mind if we dive in?
Let's do it.
You are not afraid to tread into conversations that many in your position fear to tread or aren't allowed to. I mean, until very recently, obviously, you were not muzzled by the T's and C's of the BBC, but to a degree, you were obliged to remain utterly impartial. And I wondered why and when you felt compelled to speak up at times and put your head above the parapet, because I only have to look through your Instagram feed to see that there are times when you have done exactly that. You've spoken out on the treatment or mistreatment of people and stories and misleading headlines and even Piers Morgan.
I think, yeah, there's a, you know what the BBC is like. The BBC is a wonderful beast. And I always feel fundamentally that the broadcasting landscape would be much worse off without the BBC. I think there's some brilliant people there, and I loved working for the BBC, and hopefully I will again one day. And it's not that I feel, oh, I'm free now, because, you know, I used to, sometimes I'd talk about a subject when I was on the BBC and I'd get told off, but that still happens now.
I've been there and I never, this was never at the BBC. It's like, you know, can you come upstairs, please? You go, oh God, what have I said? And then the moment they say Ofcom, you go, oh no, what have
I done? I try not to give my opinion, okay, because I'm not that interested in it. I don't think that's my job to give my opinion. I know lots of other broadcasters do that, but what I try and do is I do feel that sometimes I have an opportunity to fight other people's corners. And you said earlier about you enjoyed telling people stories. That's what I love doing. So I will count, you know, if I, like we did on BBC Breakfast, if I meet some old fella in the park who I think I can help him to get a fly past because he's been looking after a memorial for, you know, the best part of half a century, I'll do it. And I don't mind ringing up the UK, the US ambassador to the UK, and I don't mind, you know, spending my time doing that. Or whether it's the old fella who doesn't have a Christmas tree and hasn't had one for 20 years. I don't mind saying, why are we not looking after our old people in this country? And, you know, loneliness is a massive issue. Let's highlight that by going around this guy's house and getting a local choir to sing, you know, his favourite carol outside. And that gets watched millions of times on YouTube and thousands of people sign up to Age UK to be carer. I think that's good use of my platform, I feel.
But equally, you also did say, hey, Matt Hancock, whilst he was in the jungle, your rumoured £400,000 fee, why don't you really show people how much you care by donating it to an NHS cause? Now, that's quite different to helping an old man get a Christmas tree.
I don't want you to think that I'm at home watching I'm a Celeb getting angry. I wasn't angry about that.
I was. Why shouldn't you? You know, allowed to be. I mean, no, you're allowed to be.
I feel fundamentally that I wonder, can you put your head on the pillow at night and think, okay, I've done a good day's work today, or that's acceptable? And I think sometimes with things like that, I wonder whether somebody like Matt Hancock would be thinking, is that the right thing to have done? I know he's trying to repair his image. I know he's trying to go on TV, and he has a right to go on TV. That's not a problem. But my issue with that was that so many people would be watching that and might be triggered by that, or might be so angry that he was there earning all that money when he was instrumental, you know, made some really big decisions during the pandemic, which still are affecting families now. And I just thought, I'm not sure that anyone's done the right thing.
Do you know what, though? If 10 years ago, right, you sat down and somebody had said to you, in 10 years' time, this is the news that you're going to be reporting. There will have been, you know, a handful of prime ministers within a handful of months, right? I mean, like, the level of farce that you have had to navigate, report, has been quite extraordinary, actually, hasn't it? You know, but I think we will look back and remember this time with slack jaws, because it has been, I mean, we've almost become a little bit numb to the absolute ridiculousness of it all.
Yeah, someone mentioned to me the other day, I've forgotten about an interview I did with Michael Gove, you know, when he was a senior minister, and he started doing, I don't know if you remember, he started doing an impression of the Scousers on, you know, BBC Breakfast. Telling people to calm down.
And inappropriate.
Are you okay, Michael? And I remember talking to Liz Truss about the influence of Russian money in London particularly, but in the UK. And, you know, she was sort of absolutely denying that there's any link whatsoever. And we'd been on her Instagram the night before. And I said, Ms. Truss, can we just show you this picture that we found on your Instagram last night? And we put it up on the screen, and I could see that her eyelids were flickering because she was like, oh no. And it was it was at a time when she was in Theresa May's cabinet, and there were five women from the cabinet, including Theresa May and Liz Truss, and they were stood next to Mrs. Lebedev, who's, you know, and that family is one of the biggest Russian donors to the Tory party and puts a lot of money into the UK.
They also own media outlets as well, right?
Yes, that's right. And they're all sort of arms around each other with a drink in hand. And remember, this is the Prime Minister at the time and four or five of the other senior cabinet members. And I think that the line at the bottom said ladies' night. And I'm thinking, I said to her, you know, can we show you this picture? Because you're saying that there is no link between Russian money and your party, or money in this country that's come from Russia. And can you explain this picture in the light of what you just said? And I just, exactly what you mentioned there before, I mean, you wouldn't even believe that you'd be having that conversation with a frontline politician who would then go on to be prime minister. Yeah. For a short space of time, but this is where we
say
are.
Short.
Yeah,
I mean, I know she's got blinky eyes, but she did it literally in a blink of an eye.
that was a strange, you know, the week the Queen sadly passed away, and you know, Liz Truss was sort of in and then out, and then I mean, what?
This is what I mean about in years to come, we'll look back and go, who was she? Oh, she was the Prime Minister. Really, I've never heard of her. It's going to be that.
It was remarkable.
Can I talk to you about some of the other times you've raised your voice when others maybe chose not to? The reporting, the man that broke the news around the passing of the Queen and did it beautifully, I have to say, as a professional, was Hugh Edwards. And at the same time, there were multiple stories surrounding both him, as well as the likes of Philip Schofield, and the way that was unfolding elsewhere. And you quite calmly came in and posted on your Instagram just a kind of message of like, right, you know, everybody just needs to remember that some people here are very close to the edge. And you spoke up when many, many, many colleagues that don't know them, and I'm sure that you know Hugh, I have no idea if you knew Philip. What made you want to walk into that as a conversation?
Concern, I think, Kate. I often, when I think about...
Such a tricky subject,
I know.
Because we don't know the full facts for a start, and I should say that now.
We don't know the full facts, and we don't know what has happened or will happen and what will come out. But I just think... we have a tendency in a situation like that, Philip Schofield, Hugh Edwards, whatever it might be, you know, even the Holly Willoughby stuff more recently, people just fire off rockets in every direction, and you don't know what you're going to hit and what you're going to cause and what sort of damage you're going to do. Now, I think one of the points I made at the time was I hope everybody involved is okay. And I genuinely mean that, because these things, if you're in the front page of a paper, or, you know, people are talking about you and really being disparaging and saying horrible things about you, I don't care who you are, that affects you. And I often go back to my good friend Gary Speed, who took his own life.
Yes.
I'd known him well, and I was on Football Focus with him on the Saturday, spent most of the day with him, and then I had a phone call from Alan Shearer the next morning to say, have you heard about Gary? And Gary had taken his own life. And it was front page and back page news, because he was one of the first... like men who seemed like they had the perfect life, and yet he decided that he didn't want to be around anymore. Had two beautiful young boys. Everything was going seemingly his way. And I often think about, you know, how did I leave that situation? And how did Gary feel when he left me and then left the Massive Bay Studios and went back home? And I've gone over every single word that we said to each other time after time after time after time. And ever since I've done that interview, I think that's one of the reasons why, Kate, that I'm not so confrontational in interviews as other people are, because I know it's important that you leave things the right way, because you never know what the next day is going to bring. And I think having been through that and sort of the, you know, the conversation that you have with yourself for many years after that, I just think that you never know what's going on in those quiet corners of someone's house, however big that house is. Do you know what I mean? And I worry about where we leave people because of the things that we say about them. And that was where it came from. It came from a level of concern to make sure that if you've done something wrong and you've hurt someone and you've been unprofessional or you've been cruel, then fair enough, you take the hit for that and you might lose your job and you might even have to, you know, face a court case for that. And that's fine and that's okay.
And that's due process, right?
Due process.
I think, was your issue that there was no allowing anybody to have due process, because there was just so much noise that we may not even get to due process because somebody might have done something as extreme as Gary had done many years
and
previously.
I think we get so judgmental when we don't know the facts, and I think that's part of the, you know, modern media obsessed society that we live in, where, you know, straight away you're out on the street, you're doing a vox pop about what you think about, you know, these people, what do you think about that, and nobody knows. But then, sack him, get rid of him. You know, we should lock him up, or where's the death penalty? He's like, come on, just have a think about The impact those words have. I'm not saying that people should avoid punishment for things that they've done wrong. I just think we need to take care of each other. I often go back to the Caroline Flack thing as well. You know, people in the media just kept pressing her buttons, just never let her go. Just kept saying she was average and kept saying she looked like this and kept jabbing away at her without any care. And then what happened. And then, you know, people come out and say, oh, it's so sad. I was like, well, hold on a minute. You should be pointing the finger at yourself. And you should be really having a long, hard look about the words that you wrote and the impact they had.
I think you're right. You know, we have to allow processes to unfold. You know, situations like, for example, with Hugh or with Philip Schofield, they will be investigated. That doesn't happen in time for the 5 o'clock news tonight, where you go out and prod somebody and ask them to have an extreme soundbite. That's not news gathering, I don't think.
But I also think that I won't go into details of the stories because I don't want to betray anybody, but there have been times when I've been asked to cover a certain story in a certain way and I've said no. And I've got in trouble for that on occasions, but I think it's important that... No, I'm not going to interview somebody who's literally just going to drag someone through the coals even though they don't know the details. But we need to fill 5 minutes. Well, find something else to do then. Like, find something that's, you know, find a good story to put in there. I'm not saying we have a blinkered view of the world, but I think sometimes we've just got to be careful with how we deal with things. And I've got kids. I've got a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 13-year-old, and they're brilliant, but they're growing up in a world which is very different to the one I think that I grew up in.
So I was doing the football run at the weekend and picking my son and his friends up, and they all sat in the back of the car. And you know, you have these conversations, and you realise all their news comes from TikTok. They're talking about things like, they were talking about Palestine, Palestinians, and their view was a shared one. And you could see that they were all consuming pretty much the same algorithms. So I'm not saying what they thought was right or wrong. It was just they weren't presented with an objective set of facts so that they could arrive at their own opinion, and that worries me for life going forward, because we are it's echo chambers.
Yeah, and exactly, and that's why things, you know, some of the, I remember, you know, every time something like Brexit happens or Donald Trump gets elected in America, the sort of left-leaning side of the media are absolutely, how did that happen? It's because you're not listening to what people are actually saying and what people are actually thinking, because you're on social media and you just follow people that are exactly like you. We all need to broaden our horizons a little bit.
You know what I do? I actively go out of my way to follow people that I don't agree with.
Amen to that.
Just to try and cook the algorithms. That's what I try to do. I try to game the algorithms.
That's what I go and speak to. I run a bursary and a scholarship scheme at Sheffield University. I go and speak to their students every year, and the journalism students. And I say to them, you know, get out there and be on social media, but make sure that about half the people that you follow, you fundamentally disagree with.
Do you? That's good.
Yeah. Because I think that otherwise you just think, well, everyone thinks like me. And then you're surprised that someone's got a
different... You're so righteous. before we move off this question, there was a brilliant exchange that I just... I thought you styled it beautifully. So to give some background, you'd first met Piers Morgan, who went on to be your sofa rival, right, at breakfast. At a function, and it was when you just started at BBC Breakfast, and you said, he came over to you and said to you, you're going to be terrible, we're going to annihilate you. And I can totally imagine Piers saying that. And then you said, I met him again after he walked off GMB, and I told him, all those years you were on GMB, you mentioned me almost every day, and we didn't mention your name once until the day you left.
I did say it with a big smile on my face.
Because you're actually mates, aren't you?
Yeah, and Piers is brilliant at his job, right? And I remember once we met and he went, oh, you and me, we're very similar, aren't we? I went, I'm going to stop you there, Piers. Because we're not. But there's nothing wrong with that. And I think, you know, the good thing about choice is that you could watch BBC Breakfast or you could watch Good Morning Britain, and that's fine. And he's a very good journalist. I probably would approach the vast majority of stories and interviews in a different way to the way that he would do it. Mm-hmm. And again, that's fine. And I'm not saying that my way is right and his way is wrong, but give you an idea of what, when we just been on BBC Breakfast and GMB for about 6 months, and then we played golf in a big tournament, the BMW PGA at Wentworth with Kevin Peterson, and lots of people following us around all day. And Piers sort of said, about six holes in, he goes, Dan, I paid my mate to come down and take some pictures today. Do you think if I just put my hands around your neck and you sort of laugh as I'm shaking your neck? I was like, this is what you're up against. Like, he never switches off, but that's why
he doesn't. And then he'd have posted that with some sort of, exactly. Dan trying to come to terms with my increasing ratings, omitting the fact that you are still beating him.
I know, but listen,
in the ratings,
we had a healthy, we had a healthy rivalry, and I think it was probably good for both programmes. But
there was a sportsmanship about it. Do you remember when he tweeted about the the Rio Olympics? He said, I just can't get excited by silver and bronze medals. You win or you lose. Your response was, for someone who's gone on record before saying they detest silver medals, 5 years in second place must hurt quite a bit.
I know. It's a bit, there was a bit of my car's bigger than your car sometimes, which I'm not sure is the best way to do it.
Willy waving is what we call it. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but it was all done in good jest. So I still think there are times, and I've told him this, that he crossed the line, and I don't feel that I did cross the line. And I think the important thing is, I'm upset for him that he left in the way that he did. That it ended in GMB the way that it did, because I think you always want to leave somewhere with the respect of your colleagues and thinking, thank you very much for working with me. We enjoyed it, and I never like it when it ends like that for anybody.
Well, that's very gallant of you, because I'm sure that were I talking to Piers right now and you had left under the same circumstances from the BBC Breakfast sofa, he would not be saying the same.
Well.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, let's move from one small screen, self-proclaimed hero, to another for question number two. You have the mighty mustachioed Des Lynam to thank for your first proper careers advice, which you seemingly, Dan, followed to the T. But I think about, the number of times that we get people write to us or contact us asking for advice. And I just think, gosh, I wish I'd been a bit more Des Lynam at times. I mean, definitely I've responded in the past, but have I responded with the same level of detail and encouragement that Des gave you? I hope so, but I doubt it. So I wondered when else somebody has shown you an extraordinary act of kindness and support that's really helped you along the way.
Okay, that is a question, isn't it?
Because you think about what that did, that letter, that almost gave you a license to believe your dream to become the next Des Lynam,
yeah,
right? It felt attainable because the actual Des Lynam had come back to you, right? And when you're living in Crawley or you're living in the Cotswolds as I was, for somebody to even acknowledge your existence feels epic in that moment, doesn't it?
Yeah. I was an 11-year-old kid and I wrote to Des Lynam and he wrote back and said, you know, do your GCSEs, do your A-levels, go to university, don't do a media degree, do something in English or history, something that teaches you to write, and then get a job in local radio. And once you've done that, write back to me. And I didn't think I would follow that path because I was going to be a teacher. And then I got turned down for being too immature.
Because you dropped your trousers at the interview, Dan.
That is true. But
it wasn't without foundation. and just so that isn't misleading and we don't end up, you know, with some sort of headline around that, you were wearing a sports kit underneath. You were trying to explain that you were going off to...
That's
why
fine.
You dropped your trousers. You weren't trying to win the day.
Exactly. Very important, Kate. The lady who was interviewing, you've got red socks on. I'm worried about you being the teacher who teaches the kids nothing but is their friend. And I went, hold on a minute. You're judging me on my socks. I've got these socks on because I've got my football kit underneath my suit that I borrowed and I dropped my trousers to show that. Not the wisest thing I've ever done, and I probably was rightfully removed from that course.
But great that she did remove you from the course because then it was like, okay, back to Des in the studio.
Exactly, yeah. And I've had the opportunity to thank him since then. But I'm going to mention two things. Right, one was just an act of kindness which meant an awful lot to me. I was in... Poland a few years ago covering the European Championships and I had a slightly strange lump in my stomach. I felt like my breathing was changing a little bit and I went to the medical centre in the broadcast centre there and within 2.5 minutes I was in the back of an ambulance on my way to Polish A&E and a guy called Richard Hughes, who is the editor of Match of the Day now, and a guy I've worked with for many years, he dropped everything and came with me. And you know, times in your life when you think, sometimes you need someone to hold your hand. Because it did get a bit scary that night. About 2 o'clock in the morning, a Polish consultant came in and told me that I had cancer because they'd seen some shadows on my kidney. And like, he used the word tumour, and we had a fixer with us who spoke Polish and English. And I said to her, I just heard that word. Can you just confirm? Is that the same in Polish as in English? Is he talking about tumour as in cancer? And she came back and she went, yes, he is. He says, he thinks you've got cancer in your kidney. And Richard sat right next to me there. And like, you have that time where you're thinking, okay, let's process this. What do I do about that? Do I ring my family? Do I ring my wife? And I just talked to Richard about it. And he was brilliant and just really calm and, you know, he's a lovely sort of rugby-playing Welsh lad, but he's very wise and daft and lovely, and he was just brilliant that night. And I said, we had a chat, and I said to the our fixer, I said, will you ask, I don't mean this to sound rude in any way, but is the head consultant around and can they have a look at the scan? Because if I'm going to tell my family that I've got cancer, I need to know 100%. And the lady said, the head consultant, she's coming in at 8 o'clock in the morning and she can have a look at the scan. And then at 8 o'clock in the morning, she came in straight away and she said, I've got good news. It's not a tumour.
You had the whole night thinking it might be.
I know. Yeah, I know. So it was a pretty weird night, but Richard made it. No, I didn't go to a dark place or anything. I was like, okay, well, you know, if this is the case, then this is what I'll do and this is how I'll think about it. But Richard was there and really sort of held my hand through all of it. And, when we see each other, I'll just look at, someone who's been there when you really need them, I just look at him and think, Richard, whatever you need from me at any stage in life, I will always deliver the goods because you were there when I needed you.
Tell me, Dan, what did you What did you think that night when you thought, okay, I may, there's a very strong possibility that this doctor could be right? And does it sharpen and focus your thinking?
Yeah, it does. In the same way that when I had my bike accident in February of this year, and I was out for the count for 20 minutes, and I had like a weird sort of out-of-body experience that day, and I was watching myself on the floor looking at the paramedics, and then I remember being almost like, it's going to sound really strange, this, Kate, I have no way of explaining it to you, but I almost felt like I was sucked back into my body, and then I started looking out of my eyes again, and then the circle sort of got bigger and bigger, and then I could see them, but I couldn't hear them, and then like the sound came back into my brain, and then they were talking to me.
And you were out cold for 20 minutes, so this is you coming back round.
Yeah, yeah. And I was in my mind, I was cycling along this beautiful French boulevard. I've never cycled on a French boulevard, but I was there, tree lined with baguettes and jam in the basket of this bike, sort of cycling
along.
So you're
kind of tripping out, Dan. I mean, look, I must point out here, you're in Sheffield.
Yes, I was in Sheffield on a very wet and cold morning, and I was lying on the tarmac of a roundabout in Sheffield, like just out of it. But I think anything like that just makes you reassess and makes you check and makes you think. And this is going to sound really daft now, but I did think about, I love history, I studied history at university. I thought about Charles I in Poland, because he was executed, and his quote when they said they were going to execute him was, I fear not death, I bless my Lord, I am prepared. And I think I take my faith really seriously, and you know, you don't want to die, but I always also feel that whatever happens will happen, and I feel that, you know, I'm okay with that. You know, it's sad to, there's obviously great sadness associated with death, but I also feel that I am, you know, I have a good relationship with God through Jesus Christ, and I feel that, you know, it's when that time comes, I'm ready for it, if that makes sense. Does that make sense at all?
But equally, I mean, this is straight talking coming from a man that thought that a roundabout in Sheffield could have been the Champs-Élysées. So you're making some kind of sense-ish. But yes, I do. That you're not afraid of what comes after this life, because you share a faith that gives you comfort in that moment.
Yeah, and I think that was... so I didn't sort of cry or panic in Poland. I just sort of carefully thought it through. I thought about what I would, if it was the case I had cancer, what would I say to my wife? I didn't know how serious it might be at that point. I just knew there were a series of black shadows on my kidneys, because they went down to about 30% functionality. So I had this weird sort of virus that had really affected them, and it's such a strange night, because they then came in and they pumped 8 litres of saline fluid into my body.
8 litres?
To try and get my kidney to start again. So
a huge amount of liquid.
So the next day, they let me go home the next day. They gave me these drugs to sort of line my stomach, and then these really heavy drugs to try and sort of get the kidney started again. And the next day I woke up and I went to the bathroom mirror. And part of me wishes I had taken a photograph, but I didn't, because my head was about twice the size that it is at the moment. Every part of my body was swollen, and I couldn't even get my like boxer shorts on. That's how I thought I had naked. So I couldn't get my pants on because my body was so bloated with this water that wasn't being processed.
8 litres of saline.
I was like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man from Ghostbusters. I had to wait for the kidneys to start working again, and after about 48 hours, they started to process water again, and I sort of, it's very strange, I just sort of went back to my normal size, but that was a very weird week.
God. Yeah. that and the Sheffield roundabout, that's, you know, just a hard left off the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah. And the other thing I was going to say, so that was Richard. The other one is, when I agreed to do Strictly Come Dancing, I'd said no to Strictly for 4 years, and then I said yes to it. And I had no idea what it was going to be like. All I knew was my kids had really asked me to do it, and I felt like I was doing it for the right reasons. I didn't want it, not interested in fame. I wasn't there to be famous. I wasn't there to, you know, get a job. I wasn't there to boost my profile or anything. I just wanted to do it so I could say to my children, listen, I did it and I was a bit worried about it and it's something that I'm not very good at and I don't feel comfortable doing it, but I'm going to do it and I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to give it a go and I'll be there for a couple of weeks and that'll be fine. And then I enjoyed it far more than I ever thought I would. And learning to dance was an unbelievable experience. And learning to dance with Nadia Bishkova, who, you know, for 5 years, she was the best dancer on the planet. Like, two-time world champion and admired the world over. And all of a sudden, she's teaching this numpty to dance. You know, and she totally opened my eyes to it. And it was like learning an entirely new language, which I'd shut myself off from my entire life. And I remember there was one, about weeks, I can't remember what week it was now, week six or seven. I remember when I first walked down to the dance floor, I held her hand so tight, it was ridiculous. Because I love telly, right? Like you, I love being on telly, I love the red light, I love all that business. But nobody likes looking like an absolute goon. And I've walked out there thinking, there is a chance here that I could look a complete fool, right? And I walked out and I held her hand really tight and I was smiling and looking like I was enjoying myself. And I was enjoying myself, but I was like, oh, Daniel, come on. And then 6 or 7 weeks in, I remember we walked out and I was like, I had my chest out like this. I was like walking like a tiger out onto the dance floor. She looked at me and she went, are you okay? I went, oh yeah, you're fine now. She went, what do you mean? He goes, I feel as comfortable on this dance floor as I do in a TV studio. And she went, this is fantastic. I said, you've got TV Dan now. And she went, oh, I like TV Dan. Is there anything you'd like me to do? And I went, just keep up, will you? Two-time world champion, by the way.
I love it. But I know, I mean, this takes me really quite nicely to my third and final question for you. But I know that you would, the teenage boy in you that admired sports stars so much that, you know, you were the guy that probably had a Daley Thompson poster instead of a Madonna one in your bedroom.
I did.
Are you kidding me?
I did. I had Daley Thompson. I had Garth Crooks. I've got a cardboard cutout of Gary Lineker still in my loft. There was a local bookshop in my hometown of Crawley. And when Gary had written a book, they had a cardboard cutout of Gary Lineker. And I went to the bookshop after Christmas. I said, is there any way that I could have that cardboard cutout of Gary Lineker? I've still got it.
So I understand the reverence that you accord your dance partner, because in your world, she's a superstar because she is a world champion. And I know that means so much to you. So maybe Strictly qualifies in amongst your response to my third and final question. Let's find out.
Okay.
As a live television junkie, you are drawn to big moments. But I wondered, what have been the big moments in your own life, the ones that went on to put a rung on your ladder? And I'm sure that when you signed up for Strictly, you never expected it to be as informative as it is. But the week that we're talking, for example, Christian Guru Murphy has just gone out. Another great news man. And he wept.
Yeah.
He wept when he left the competition because, you know, he loved it so much. He got so much from it. I've done Strictly. I've hosted the tour. I've seen the magic that sits within the bubble. So I get it. But I'm not sure that people really understand how that glitter gets you. It really got you, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Well, I think I enjoyed it 10 times more than I thought I would. I as somebody who loves live telly as well, Strictly is like, it's the biggest show on the box. And they basically employed everybody who's brilliant at their jobs to come together, whether that's wardrobe, makeup, hair, lighting, floor managers, you know, everybody's
like,
brilliant
like the
at their job.
And they put them for Saturday nights, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. And I just think I expected to be there for 3 weeks maximum, and I was there for 3 months. And actually, it became, now, I was almost like playing a game. You know what these programs are like. You know, they're very heavily produced, and I think nobody had seen me dance before I started. Including me, and they've got no idea how good you're going to be. And then I think, you know, in their minds, oh, he'll be here for 4 or 5 weeks maximum. We kind of, you know, people kind of like him. They watch him on Breakfast, and then we'll get rid of him. And actually, we were there for like 11 or 12
weeks.
Yeah, you
came fifth, Dan. That's some guy.
I enjoy pushing myself, Kate. I love being tested. And I also love spending time with people who are brilliant at what they do. And I watched, watching Nadia and watching Nikita and, you know, Graziano and Giovanni and Karen and Diane, watching these people who are brilliant at what they do, I always think, I can learn something from you. And I've always been like that around brilliant people, whether they're sports stars or whether they're, you know, business champions or whether they're, you know, brilliant chefs or whatever it is. I'm thinking, you've spent a lifetime learning that skill. I can take something from you and that can make me better at what I do. And I said to, I saw Nadia a few weeks ago and I said to her, you've made me a better presenter. I'm a better presenter because of what you taught me on Strictly Come Dancing.
How's that informed your presenting? And I think that's
Well, I just think I, for a start, I walk differently. She changed my walk week one. but I also think that it gives me, because I'm confident, I've always been super confident in every studio that I walk into. And I think the one part of my life where I thought, that's what other people do, was dancing. Other people dance and enjoy it. I can't do that. It's just, you know, I'll hold your handbag at a wedding. I'll organise drinks. I'll take the kids.
I'll take the photos, yeah, while you all dance.
I'll do the photos. You know, I'll do the funny, oh, look at me, walk like an Egyptian. And that's as far as it goes, right? You know that person. Yeah. But I think what Strictly taught me was that there's no barriers. Like, and I learned from Nadia and from that program that actually there aren't, don't limit yourself. Don't think you can't do that. And I think there was one week where, bear in mind, I'd never sort of done any dancing before at all. And then I think we did an American Smooth and I was injured the whole week, right? And I hadn't been able to dance at all. And for anybody, the way that Strictly works is you sort of train Monday, as you well know, you train Monday to Thursday. Friday, you're in the studio doing a dress rehearsal and sort of checking the lights and sound and all that. And then Saturday's the program. So it's Thursday morning, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, and I've not danced a step of our American Smooth, right? And my leg is really hurting. It's got a little bit better overnight. And all I've done is I've watched Nadia dance my steps and tried to take it in. That's it. I've just been sat on the side watching her for 3 days. And I walked in on the Thursday morning and I said, right, partner, how long have we got today to learn this? And she went, I've got a car coming to take us to It Takes Two at 4 o'clock this afternoon. I went, okay, we've got 6 hours. I'm going to learn it in 6 hours.
Did you? Because it's technical, the American Smooth.
Yeah, I know. I did all these funky lifts. And I've just switched my head on. And what she said to me was, we've got 6 hours to make this work. Otherwise, we're going home. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to go home. I'm enjoying this. So I just learned it in 6 hours. And that's the highest score we got in the competition. Now, if an idiot like me, Kate, can learn an American Smooth in 6 hours and dance it in front of 11, 12 million people on Saturday night and not make a mistake, then there are no limits to what I can do. Yeah. Does that make sense? That's what really taught me. The thing that I really loved, you mentioned at the start that I wrote a book last year. It's called Standing on the Shelf. Basically, people who help us to see a bit further than we can on our own. And there's some amazing people in there. And when the book came out, I organised an evening in London. And almost everybody in the book, 48 people in the book, almost all of them came.
So these are, just to explain to the listeners, these are the stories of extraordinary people that have really, really impressed you with their everyday lives and achievements. The extraordinary, ordinary people.
Also in there was Rose Ayling Ellis and her mum, Donna, because I found Rose on Strictly to be such an inspiration to me. And I voted for Rose from week one. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that, but I did. Anyway.
By the way, it was the same year you competed, right?
Yeah, I was in the same year as Rose, yeah. So I told her, I remember after the first week, I said, Rose, I don't take this the wrong way, but I just had 3 votes on the app. I showed her, I said, I voted for you 3 times. That's going to be my vote every week. So I just think you're amazing.
Wasn't she?
And I just, the way that, you know, her mum, I love the fact that her mum was there almost every week and her mum had to fight her whole life for her daughter to be accepted and to have the same opportunities that everybody else had. And her mum was like, you know, Rose can do anything. There were no boundaries for my daughter, even though she's deaf. And, you know, the moment where she danced to Clean Bandit with Giovanni, just to be sat 5 metres away from that, it was just like, wow, I'll never forget
that. That was a moment, wasn't it?
So Rose, Rose is in there, but also people like Martin Hibbert, who lost the use of his legs in the Manchester Arena bomb. The three dads, who are now really well known, but I met them first on BBC Breakfast. They all lost their daughters to suicide, and they managed to raise over £1 million walking between the three houses. And I find them unbelievable. And then there's people like Tony, who I've sorted the fly pass out for. There's an amazing mum called Ilse Fieldsend, whose daughter Georgia died of a brain aneurysm, and she decided on her deathbed to donate her organs, and she gave away her eyes, and she gave away her lungs, and she gave away various parts of her body. And now the only thing that keeps her going is to know that Georgia's death is actually helping people to see and live in a world which, to be honest with you, a world without Georgia is unbelievably painful for Ilse every single day, but that's what keeps her going. So there's all these sorts of people, and an amazing woman who lost her son, Martin Hett, in the Manchester Arena bomb, called Fegan Murray. And how does she forgive the person who killed her son? And there's all these sorts of issues and people in the book, and I got them all together in one room.
Oh, wow, that must have been so emotional, Dan.
Hey, it was bananas, because I stood up on stage and I said, I just want to introduce you all to the people in this room. And I just went through them all one by one. And there was a few moments of like audible gasping, because I don't know if you remember the London Bridge attack at Fishmongers Hall. And I said, do you remember that attack? And there was a guy there called Steve Gallant, who was a murderer and had been in prison for 14 and a half years for murdering somebody in a really brutal way. That was his first ever day out of prison. And Steve Gallant attacked Usman Khan and stopped him from killing other people. There was also a guy called Darren Frost, who was the man with the narwhal tusk, who ripped it off the wall and chased Usman Khan out of Fishmongers Hall onto London Bridge. And together, these two saved dozens of lives. Both those men are in the room tonight. They stood over there. And like, it was that sort of, oh my word. And it was you remember Jimmy Olubunmi Adewole, who jumped in the Thames to save that woman who was drowning, and he lost his own life. I spoke to one of the chapters in the book is about him and about his best friend, Bernard, and his mum and his brothers are mentioned in the book. And his mum came, and his mum stood over there, and she pulled me to one side afterwards, and she said, I might get emotional telling you this, Kate, it's still the whole reason why I wrote the book. But she said, she pulled me to one side and she said, thank you for giving my son a voice. Mm. Right. And she said, I read the chapter and that was my boy. I was like, okay, that's all I ever need to hear. Thank you. Gave her a hug. And I'm still really good friends with Bernard, actually. I speak to Bernard quite regularly. But
yeah, that goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, Dan, right? You just tell stories, important stories. That's an important... For her, there was no more important a page turn than seeing her son represented in your words.
Yeah. And there's that responsibility, isn't there, Kate, to tell that story well. And there's a guy in the book who I keep coming back to as well, right? So this night was amazing. And
what a night. That's got to be a massive moment in your world, right?
Genuinely one of the best nights ever. Because all these people, you know, Darren Frost, who was the man with the narwhal tusk, met Donna, Rose's mum, and they sort of came over to each other. And I was stood right next to them when they said it. And Donna went, can I just say, Darren, I read your chapter in the book. I think what you did was amazing. And he goes, no, hold a minute. You're Rose's mum. I watched every second of Strictly last year, and I loved it, and you were brilliant, and you're amazing. And then I just thought, this is lovely to get all these people who don't see themselves as brilliant because they're so humble, inspiring each other and inspiring others. And I loved it. And there's a guy in the story of the three dads. There's a guy called Sandy, who's an architect, and Sandy was looking out of his bedroom window, his kitchen window one day, and he saw the body of one of these girls who was Andy, who's one of the three dads, his daughter. And she'd taken her own life, and he saw her on a beach. And he was so struck by this. He stayed with her body until the police turned up. But then he started thinking, you know, could I have saved her? If I'd have gone out on the bridge before she decided to jump, could I have looked after her? Could I have maybe... And he started to feel guilt, even though he'd never met this girl. And he found out a little bit more about her, and he decided to go to her funeral. And he drove from Edinburgh all the way down to Cumbria to attend her funeral. Didn't know anybody, right? And he's outside the church, and then he went to the wake, and he's there in tears because for him it was really important for him to know that Sophie was loved, and he saw these people at the funeral, and that really helped him. And then somebody came up to him and said, "Are you are you part of the family? Why are you here? And he goes, oh, I just, this is going to sound really weird, but I just needed to be here. And he started talking to this guy called Nigel. And he said, explained that he'd found Sophie's body. And Nigel said, can you come inside, please? And so he went inside, and Nigel went up to Andy, who's Sophie's dad. And he said, Andy, I need you to introduce you to this guy. And Andy like looked at him and went, okay, I'm at the, you know, I'm at my daughter's funeral. This better be important. And Nigel said, remember that the police told you that somebody stayed by your daughter's body until they turned up. This is the guy. And Andy had always felt that was so important to him, that somebody looked after his daughter. And these two men sort of embraced. And Sophie's last ever present that she bought her dad was she died at Christmas, and she bought him a Christmas present that year. And the Christmas present was a whiskey tour in Edinburgh. They do a whiskey tour up in Edinburgh, and she bought him that as a present. And I love the fact that every single year that Andy and Sandy and the families gather together on that beach where he found Sophie's body, and they, you know, they remember her together. And Andy and Sandy have been on that whiskey tour together, and they're still really good friends. And when Andy decided to run the Bamborough Half Marathon in the place of his daughter, who couldn't take the place because she was no longer with us, he trained like you wouldn't believe to do this, and he crossed the finish line. And guess who was on the finish line? Sandy had cycled all the way from Edinburgh for 2 days to be there when Andy crossed the finish line. Now that, Kate, for me, I think about him a lot, because when Sophie decided for whatever reason to take her own life, you think every decision that we make has ripples. And I love the fact that out of the most awkward, difficult, painful thing that family have ever been through, there's this beautiful friendship, which I know keeps Andy going every single day. And Sandy, we all need a bit of Sandy in our life. He's a softly spoken, gorgeous Scotsman who genuinely has opened my eyes to what it means to be sacrificial and caring and sort of loving towards other people.
You need to put these stories on screen at Channel 5, Dan, because, I mean, and do you know what? Listening to them all, the themes are, you know, redemption, adversity, forgiveness, resilience. They're great. They're almost, it's almost like a Bible reading, isn't it? There's, you know, in terms of, you know, in terms of your faith, so many of the themes of the Christian faith run through these stories, these people, and the extraordinary circumstances that, in which they find themselves.
Yeah, and I think that is at the heart of who I am. And my faith is really important to me. It is what makes me tick. It informs the things I say, the jobs that I do, the things I say no to, the everything, the, you know, the words that come out of my mouth, all those things. And I also think, Kate, it gives me a real perspective as well, because you know what this job is like. It has the ability to take you right up here and drag you right down there. And the things that people say to you and about you can really make a big impact on people. And I've seen that, I'm sure you have as well, where people are really low, and even though they've got an amazing job, it's hard, and they struggle to get out of bed in the morning because it's constantly like a toffee hammer on your head every single day. And I think that my faith is one of the things that enables me to keep a sense of perspective, and I don't get taken too high or dragged too low, because I know that my value doesn't come from what people say about me or write about me or think about me. I know that I'm valued by God, and that really keeps me on that sort of narrow path, if that makes
sense.
This
is what, if these are the stabilizers that you use to stay in the right side of this business in terms of your sanity, your self-worth, the way you identify yourself, if that's what helps you to do that, fantastic, you know. But I do, when you look through the collection of stories that you've pulled together for Standing on the Shoulders, I did really see a lot of Christian values running through why you were drawn to these people in the first place. And they are really, I mean, it's a beautiful collection of stories. It really is. And difficult reads at times, but my goodness, it restores your faith in people who have found themselves in the worst of places, and it shows the best of them.
Don't you find that that's what, you know, I jump out of bed every morning, Kate, because I love my job, and I love my family, and I love the opportunity to tell these people's stories. And what I find fascinating about everybody in that book and people that you meet every day is that I love spending time with people who have been in some of these impossible situations where grief completely consumes you, or guilt is dragging you down every day, and you think you're in the deepest, darkest pit it's possible for a human to be in, and yet there is something inside them that makes them turn around and look towards that light at the end of that tunnel, however far away that might be.
Find the light. Yeah. It's a wonderful book, and I've loved talking to you today. Thank you so much, Dan, for your time.
Thank you, Kate.
I really hope that we get to do it in real life one day.
Yes, and you know what? This is nice for me, because everyone has always told me that you are really lovely and great to work with and a really kind person.
Thanks.
And a brilliant broadcaster. And the only thing I've known is that you're a brilliant broadcaster, Kate, but now I know all the other things are true as well.
Dan, you're going to make me cry. Honestly, my hormones are off the scale right now. That means an enormous amount coming from an actual giant in the telly world. So thank you. Thank you. And yeah, I really do hope we get to do it again in person. And I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to do this face to face with you, because that would have been lovely.
I'll bring a pint of milk.
Yeah, and I'll bring my ninth espresso of the day. Sod it, let's just go out and have a drink, shall we? Chats with other great broadcasters. We have episodes in our back catalogue with Ben Shepherd, Richard and Judy, Ruth Langsford, Eamon Holmes, Lorraine Kelly, Craig Doyle, Vernon Kay, Simon Mayo, Ken Bruce, and so many more. I'll be back with you on Tuesday with a mini episode of Something from the Cellar to whet your midweek whistle. Until then, thanks as always for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.